Part 5 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Book 2, Chapters 7 through 11.
We have left our protagonist, Carl Jung, in Chapter 6 of Book 2 last time, which was entitled Death, and in which he contemplated, as you may recall, this was toward the end of the lecture, two horrors, as he called them, death and birth. So we start in a horrible way and we end in a horrible way. And I would say that that's pretty close to the truth from what I have seen. I deliberately stay away from observing births, my own having been a very difficult one, and I generally being disinclined toward that sort of thing. But as a clergyman, I certainly had to be present at a number of deaths, and it's not my favorite occupation, as I don't think it is really of anyone else. So he is quite correct about having serious misgivings about the beginning and the ending of earthly life. So it's quite clear that his impressions of death and of, as he calls it, the hell that is connected with it are influenced also by World War I, which by this time when he wrote these was there, certainly beginning in a big way. And that was, after all, the first real hell experience at the collective level of Europe since the Napoleonic Wars, which were really more in the nature of purgatory in comparison. So significantly, Jung ends that chapter with some very derogatory statements about birth, which he, in typical Gnostic fashion, refers to as the horrors of birth. We need to keep in mind that in chapter 6, death is inserted after a long sequence about the experiences with the anchorite, which now continue again in the chapter 7 entitled The Remains of Earlier Temples. So Jung now finds himself in a pleasant countryside of wide meadows and a carpet of flowers, rolling soft hills and a fresh green wood in the distance. Certainly a big difference from the desert countryside where he met the anchorite. And that is, of course, on purpose. While wandering around in this pleasant country, he encounters two figures approaching, an old monk and a tall, gangly man in a faded red garment. The latter is the deteriorated form of the red man, whom we first encountered in chapter 2 of book 2, and whom we identified as a sort of Mephistophelian worldly spirit, as you may recall. The monk looks not at all wasted like his companion, but rather paunchy and a bit dissolute, which is an improper way for monks to look. So he turns out to be a somewhat changed form of, perhaps you guessed it, Ammonius the anchorite. The two look upon Jung with fright, and he in turn notices that his own body, that is Jung's, has sprouted green leaves, which would be a bit disturbing, at least to some of us who are not given to the eating of fresh green leafy vegetables. For others, that might be a way in which they may be provided with that sort of thing. So Ammonius, the anchorite, greets Jung with the Greek formula for "Be gone, Satan, apage Satanas." And the red one calls him "You damned pagan riffraff." So it's quite a pleasant forms of greetings that he receives there. These two strange persons both seem embarrassed about their present condition. But finally, Ammonius, the anchorite, begins to tell his story. He recounts that he abandoned his anchorite status, and that he had done so on the basis of Jung's statements to him to the effect that, and I quote, he needed the closeness of men to arrive at the higher understanding, the higher mysteries. So Jung is receiving the blame now about what happened to the anchorite subsequent to receiving that advice. Following this advice, Ammonius persuaded his brother anchorites to abandon their solitary ways and to band together in a monastery. Now, I think I may have mentioned at the very beginning when the term anchorite came up, that these were sort of the two ancient forms of contemplative life. The anchorite being one and the cenobite being the other. The anchorites being like individual hermits who would go off initially into the desert because that was the loneliest place that they could find. And the cenobites, however, being people who formed a community of like-minded persons, and that's of course what monasticism then eventually became. Now, in this case, the monks established themselves in a monastery near the Nile, where they cultivated the fields, and apparently became sort of more and more worldly and less spiritual in their behavior and in their orientation. And so Ammonius the anchorite, thus being in touch again with humanity, perhaps even with his own humanity, first said that he developed a great desire to journey to Alexandria, which of course was the great metropolis in that part of the world. But he did not remain in Alexandria, but he climbed aboard the ship and traveled to Rome. And then he did, so it would seem, having gotten to Rome, he did as the Romans do, and he fell from grace by drinking wine and, oh, horror of horrors, consorting with women. And then he met, once again, the Red One, this strange fellow, who at last made him actually return to the monastery. The Red One tells his own tale then also, how he was dissatisfied with his own condition, and he converted himself to Christianity, and he introduced dancing into the church liturgy, motivated by something, again, presumably, that Jung had said to him earlier about dancing. So they are both blaming their subsequent life and its unsatisfactory features on the few words that Jung said to them when he met them earlier in the desert. So the likely interpretation of this story is, and that's of course strictly only of my own idea, that it has to do really with Jung's encounter with Christianity. You remember he goes out into the desert, he encounters the anchorite has a Bible there, he contemplates the Bible, and really the anchorite is sort of his first contact in these visions with the Christian religion. And he even speculates as to that whether the anchorite says strange things that don't sound quite right to him, that the anchorite might even be a Gnostic. This is in the Egyptian desert. Obviously, as he said in the book, it is in the 3rd century. And there he finds that the Christian message is sort of joined up with that of the ancient Egyptians. You may recall there is the scarab, and then he utters a very poetic prayer to the scarab, and then he utters a prayer to the sun. And all of this is sort of conflated, it sort of comes together without, however, indicating any kind of a radical conflict at all. However, when the solitude of these people, including the anchorite who is sort of the paradigmatic figure, maybe he's the paradigmatic figure of the Christian church and of the history of the church, when the anchorite leaves his solitary ways and he becomes more and more involved with people, he becomes contaminated by the world. And the red one, who is really a spirit, he also becomes contaminated by what is going on in the world. They have allowed the outer world now to enter their own nature, and they are losing their original authenticity. So if we look at, let's say, the history of the Christian faith, then we can see that in Egypt in the early centuries, it was very close to the mystery. And that this probably was, at least in part, either directly or by way of archetypal influences, connected with the fact that Egypt was the place where the very, very powerful ancient mystics, really rationalists, atheists, who have abandoned a way of spiritual thinking. So finally Jung finds quarters for Izdubar. They come to a secluded house in the midst of a secret garden, and in order to hide Izdubar, he squeezes him. Now this is really something. But you have to think here a little bit the way children think with fairy tales. You know, a fairy tale is only a very simple childish myth. It's a form of a myth. So here, what Jung does now, he takes Izdubar and he squeezes him into a shape of an egg. And he takes the egg and puts it in his pocket. So, you know, I don't think that we should be too taken aback by this, because, you know, these are the kind of things that happen to us in dreams. I don't know whether I ever actually dreamt of taking somebody and squeezing him into a shape and putting him in my pocket, but very easily could have happened. I have dreamt of way lot weirder things than that. That's very tame compared to some of the imagery that can happen. So Jung here essentially outlines a way in which the gods can be saved and remain real. He, the beautiful and most loved one, came to me from the east, from just that place which I was seeking to reach. Admiringly, I saw his power and magnificence, and I recognized that he was striving for precisely what I had abandoned, namely my dark, human, milling crowd of abjection. I recognized the blindness and unknowingness of his striving, which worked against my desire. And he lay crying like a child, as that which he was, a child, a primordial grown child that required human logos. So he lay before me helpless, my blind God, who had become self-seeing and paralyzed. And compassion seized me, since it was plain to me that I should not let him die. He who approached me from the rising, from that place where he would be well, but which I could never reach. He whom I sought, I now possessed. The East could give me nothing other than him, the sick and fallen one. You need to undertake only half of the way, he will undertake the other half. If you go beyond him, blindness will befall you. If he goes beyond you, paralysis will befall him. In any event, what he's doing here is he's sort of hinting the dangers that accompany the process of awakening the God. Nevertheless, it can be done. If we internalize the divine, as he indicates here, as we recognize it within ourselves or through ourselves, then we can save it. He writes, and I quote, "So long as we leave the God outside us, apparent and tangible, he is unbearable and hopeless. But if we turn the God into a creature of the imagination, I won't use the term fantasy, he is in us and is easy to bear." That is really the summary of this entire process. And when you will see the picture of Izdubar, he's really a scary big fellow. The German word that I translated as a creature of the imagination is Gespinst der Einbildung. I know there are some here who speak German. This is the German in the text that I think in a not very helpful fashion has been translated as fantasy, a product of the imagination, because this carries less of a devaluation than fantasy. Fantasy is almost a pejorative word. So we have to be careful, because you have to remember we don't have gods anymore, we only have words. As he mentioned before, so the words are really quite important. So we must stimulate our inner faculties of imagination to make the divinities real within us. Jung has done this with Izdubar by squeezing him into an egg and putting the egg in his pocket. At the end of chapter 9, he also warns us not to go too public with the reality of the God within. When one becomes too open and public with this truth, then people go wild and engage in harmful acts, he writes. And here are his words. Consider that your fellow men are animals without knowing it. Now, here is a good advice, folks. It would help a lot to be aware of that at least at certain times. So long as they go to pasture, the human animals, or lie in the sun, or suckle their young, or mate with each other, they are beautiful and harmless creatures of dark Mother Earth. But if the God appears, they begin to rave, since the nearness of God makes people rave. They tremble with fear and fury and attack one another in fratricidal struggles, since one senses the approaching God in the other. So conceal the God that you have taken with you. Put the egg in your pocket. Okay? Thus do not speak and do not show the God, but sit in a solitary place and sing incantations in the ancient manner. This is the beginning of the incantations, is this verse, and then I'll read some. They are fabulous. If you don't read anything else but the incantations, these are the incantations that he sings in order to heal and to revive Izdubar. But there are so many, there are 10 or 11 of them. I can't read all of them, but I'll give you some good samples. And I'll tell you where to find them. If you have the book, please read all of them. But this is how he starts. Set the egg before you, the God in his beginning, and behold it, and incubate it with the magical warmth of your gaze. And then comes chapter 10, which the chapter is called Incantations. But here again, it's interesting because there are several. I mean, these are poems, one after the other. And they are numbered. But in the German, he doesn't use the plural. It's not incantations, but incantation. So that they are designed to be used together. So when you do the incantation, you have to do the whole prayer, just like you don't do a magical formula and just do a part of it and then forget it and go out for a beer. you have to do the whole thing. So here they, let me see, here they are. These are truly fabulous things. So I'll give you a sampling of them. This is, and they each have a huge image that comes with them. Every one of these huge plates. And he doesn't explain how did that, but apparently that's the image that came to him with the particular incantation. So here is the incantation. He starts out, Christmas has come. The God is in the egg. I have prepared a rug for my God, an expensive red rug from the land of mourning. Get good Persian rugs. Very important. Red rug from the land of the mourning. He shall be surrounded by the shimmer of magnificence of his eastern land. I am the mother, the simple maiden who gave birth and did not know how. I am the careful father who protected the maiden. I am the shepherd who received the message as he guarded his herd that night on the dark field. So it's Christmas. It's the Christmas Eve. The God is born from the egg. Then the solemn hours lengthen, and my humanity is wretched and suffers torment, since I am a giver of birth. Whence do you delight me, O God? He is the eternal emptiness and the eternal fullness. Nothing resembles him, and he resembles everything. Eternal darkness and eternal brightness. Eternal below and eternal above. Double nature in one. Simple in the manifold meaning, in absurdity, freedom in bondage, subjugated when victorious, old in youth, yes in no. And here is one that in the format really resembles old Gnostic and especially Manichaean psalms in an incredible fashion. Amen, you are the Lord of the beginning. Amen, you are the star of the east. Amen, you are the flower that blooms over everything. Amen, you are the deer that breaks out of the forest. Amen, you are the song that sounds far over the water. Amen, you are the beginning and the end. Each one of these incantations is just like this. And now we are coming toward the latter part. This is really the last stanza of the incantations. We asked earth, we asked heaven, we asked the sea, we asked the wind, we asked the fire. We looked for you with all the peoples, we looked for you with all the kings, we looked for you with all the wise, we looked for you in our own heads and hearts, and we found you in the egg. I have slain a precious human sacrifice for you, a youth and old man. I have cut my skin with a knife. I have sprinkled your altar with my own blood. I have banished my father and mother so that you can live with me. Clearing out other elements in one's mind. I have turned my night into day and went about it midday like a sleepwalker. I have overthrown all the other gods, broken the laws, eaten the impure. I have thrown down my sword and dressed in woman's clothing. Well, Carl, really? I shattered my firm castle and played like a child in the sand. I saw warriors form into line of battle and destroyed my suit of armor with a hammer. I planted my field and let the fruit decay. I made small everything that was great and made everything great that was small. I exchanged my furthest goal for the nearest, and so I am ready. He's now ready for the God to come forth from the egg. In the ensuing passages, then Jung shows ambivalence and voices complaints about the task of raising the God from the egg. You know, now he's afraid. He fears that he has diminished the mighty one, shrinking him into the size of an egg. I can see that. He has made God pitiful. He has treated God in an unworthy manner. And Jung addresses the God in the egg as follows. My God, I love you as a mother loves the unborn whom she carries in her heart. Grow in the egg of the East. Nourish yourself from my love. Drink the juice of my life so that you will become a radiant God once more. We need your light, O child. Since we go in darkness, light up our paths. May your light shine before us. May your fire warm the coldness of our life. We do not need your power, but life. So this is the... you can see how the mind, you know, the psyche, becomes fixated on power. Power, you know. But there is something other than power. It's life. And that is not just obviously physical life. It's like what the Jews call chai. You know, it's life. Lachaim, to drink to life. It's Kabbalistically certainly doesn't just mean the physical life, but it means the great life. It is the life of God. It is the life that God is. Mm-hmm. So, I have to do this one, it won't last long. The opening of the egg is chapter 11. Jung then describes the opening of the egg and Isdobar's reaction to his new condition in a following manner. On the evening of the third day, I kneel down on the rug and carefully open the egg. So it's, you don't wait apparently for the egg to open. Something resembling smoke rises up from it, and suddenly Isdobar is standing before me, enormous, transformed, and complete. His limbs are whole, and I find no trace of damage on them. It's as if he had awoken from a deep sleep. He says, "Where am I? How narrow it is here, how dark, how cool. Am I in the grave? Where was I? It seemed to me as if I had been outside in the universe. Over and under me was an endlessly dark, glittering sky, and I was in passion of unspeakable yearning. Streams of fire broke from my radiating body. I surged through blazing flames. I swam in a sea that wrapped me in living fires, full of light, full of longing, full of eternity. I was ancient and perpetually renewing myself, falling from the heights to the depths and world, glowing from the depths to the heights, hovering around myself amidst glowing clouds, as raining embers beating down like the foam of the surf, engulfing myself in stifling heat, embracing and rejecting myself in a boundless game. Where was I? I was completely the sun." Sonne, you know. In much of the remaining portions of the chapter, Jung reflects over the predicaments and agonies that befall a person who has liberated a god, as he has in his story concerning Isdobar. These statements in some ways resemble the condition great mystics and seers find themselves in after having partaken of a beatific vision of divinity. I might also mention that it is also a reaction that we frequently find in the wake of very, very powerful psychedelic experiences where the person comes back and says, so to say, now what? Now what? I've been there, I've seen all of this, you might say, I've given birth to the God, but now what? Where do I go now? And so this, you know, this becomes a predicament. And he sees himself as the dreadfully deformed brother of the God. And so now that Isdobar has come forth, and Isdobar flies up in the sky in triumph, at least at one point he does, he says, now I have to keep on doing what I can. I have to accept the evil in the world, because the temptation is, it would be very great now to try to go with Isdobar, but I really can't. I have to stay here. I have to deal with a world that is still evil, even though I have liberated the God. In a somewhat Tolstoy-like fashion, he advises us not to resist or to battle with evil under these circumstances, but rather to accept it. And of course, much could be said about that in terms of the shadow and so forth. But I think here at this point, the Gnostic implications are very powerful, that we live in a world that is riddled with darkness. Even our very bodies and psyches are not free from it. He looks at his body and he sees it there. If we accept this as an existential condition, pure and simple, then it will not have the power to overwhelm us. And, of course, another very important issue is if we recognize it as an existential reality, then we will not go on blaming others for it. The blame game of which we see so much and we hear about it, the blame game is almost entirely due to the fact that we cannot accept the very evident fact that things are rotten. You know? Keep this in mind. Things are rotten. And they are not rotten because somebody makes them rot. They are rotten because they are rotten, and they keep on rotting, and they keep on rotting, you know. We don't have to run around and say, oh, it's his fault, her fault. Freud already started all this fault feeding. Oh, your father, oh, your mother, your poor fathers and mothers, come on, they had enough trouble with you. I know they had with me, you know. Blame. But the issue is, it's a rotten situation. That's it. Is that so difficult to accept? An explanatory passage illustrated with images, he gives an epigrammatic final statement on which I will conclude. Nature is playful and terrible. Some see the playful side and dally with it and let it sparkle. Others see the horror and cover their heads and are more dead than alive. The way does not lead between both, but embraces both. It is both cheerful play and cold horror. So he says here, you know, now that you have done this work, you are still back in the world, you have to cope with these things, you have to accept the conditions as they are and keep on going, and then possibly some other great tasks will appertain to you. But he has done already the great and the marvelous deed of having saved this God and having restored his divinity, restored his health, and restored his life. Which, of course, has various implications in terms of the self with the capital S within the individual and all of that. But I think in this case, as we indicated before, it also had some very important historical and cultural implications, because Jung really did what he said he did here. He has really revived the spiritual essence of the culture. And he has given it new life. And in so doing, I think has done a work of real salvation. No wonder he saw himself earlier as Mithras on the cross and the resurrecting, because this is the greatest salvific work that we can do, is to restore the spirit, restore the reality, gain access and afford access to that other greater reality, show ourselves and show other people, those who are interested, those who are willing to do so, the way in which this can be approached so that it will really work, that it will really profit our spirit. And then we have removed, as Valentinus of old has said, we have removed a great fault, a great wound, a great and terrible hole in the fabric of the world. And we have helped to restore a reality that was about to die. And this is probably the greatest blessing, the greatest task, the greatest heroism that we can be called to perform. And indeed, as Jung was called to it in our other way, we are also called to do so. And let us hope and pray that as he was victorious, so we also will be victorious in that task and in that battle. Now, thank you very much.
Copyright MMDIS, BC Recordings. Catalog number 200505. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.